The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Now, if you got a letter this week, it might have had a stamp featuring Neil Jordan on it. And he joins me now, not on a stamp, in person. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Brendan.
How does it feel to be on a national postage? I'd say it's complicated, is it, becoming a kind of a national monument?
Well, not really. I didn't realise they had this programme. I think there's loads of stamps about Father Ted, you know.
Yeah.
I think Christy Moore has been on a stamp. And I didn't realise that they had this culture of putting people's faces on the stamps, you know. But when they sent it to me, I thought, oh, that's great. I never thought I'd be on a stamp.
Yeah. You're sending a lot of letters to anyone who ever doubted you.
I haven't sent any letters, but I think I'll start. You know, I mean, most people deal in email now, don't they? But, you know, it's
don't
it's,
undermine the stamp
actually,
campaign.
Can I say the GPO is this rather wonderful institution. I was down in the GPO and they make their own honey, you know?
Really, yeah.
Yeah, I swear to God. And the little courtyard in the middle of it. You know the way you go, it's like between Henry Street and Moore Street or something. You know, it's the back area of it is. And I mean, I had rebuilt the GPO, the exterior of it, for Michael Collins. You know what I mean?
Of course, yeah.
And I was in the... but I was amazed at the kind of dedication of these GPO, you know, officials and staff and, you know...
Yeah, and their pride in the institution.
Well, yeah, every time I meet Irish
civil
servants, I'm always surprised, you know, because you imagine... It'd be the most boring job in the world and perhaps to be this institutional arrogance going on. But there was none of that. It was delightful, the thing. I brought my grandkids there and they were thrilled for some strange reason. Everyone gets excited about a stamp, you know. But it was delightful. It was nice, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And the stamps, they celebrate Irish Oscar winners. And, of course, you won Best Screenplay for The Crying Game. Can I ask you, is it... For you in your life, in your career and everything, is the Oscar a big kind of standout moment of achievement? Are your metrics for success kind of different to that?
I never imagined I would win an Oscar, you know what I mean? Because I started out as a writer, as a novelist, you know what I mean? And it always seemed kind of vulgar to me somehow, you know? And when we did, I mean, I did a movie called Mona Lisa and Bob Hoskins was nominated for an Oscar. I didn't even go to accompany Bob, you know? Because he knew he wouldn't win at the time, I think. And then when we did The Crying Game, we got nominated for a bunch of Oscars. And, you know, you get competitive. You're there and you think, oh, God, okay, now we're going to beat everybody else. You know, we're going to win Best Picture. And, of course, you know you're not. But, you know, I won the best... What was the best original screenplay?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was thrilled. But it was nothing that I had ever... thought about or, you know, kind of had this great ambition for, you know, but it's like...
Do you remember being up there?
Well, I remember being at the ceremony and because for some reason they divided it between Los Angeles and New York. So it was kind of going on a long time. So I went down to the bar to have a drink and somebody, I got these sudden calls, you got to come up, you know, and... Oh my God! Okay, so you know they had a New York kind of announcement center and a Los Angeles one. So I was kind of in a rush. I was surprised. Let's put it that way, you know.
Yeah. The Irish were well represented at this year's Oscars.
Yeah, they were very well. Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, and you know, and. Jessie Buckley.
And
she's Hines, she is for, good. Yeah. Kieran, yeah, yeah. Kieran, yeah, I thought Kieran. I love Kieran. You know, everybody loves Kieran, don't they?
Yeah,
everyone
yeah.
loves Jessie Buckley, and it was good. But it was a strange event. I mean, I didn't sit up to see it, but you know, I think they blew it. Really, I really think they did. You know,
in what way?
Well, I mean, because it's in real trouble. You know, I mean, the Academy is a great institution. I know people find it weird me saying that, but after I made my first movie, for some strange reason, I got an invitation to join this thing. I never knew what it was, you know. And in a way, it's a very, very admirable organization. And the kind of the least interesting aspect of it all is the Oscar celebration every year, you know, the kind of thing.
Okay.
But I thought, I mean, they're in real trouble and... I thought they were going to, in some way, involve one of their own in this event, like Zelensky, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been such a brilliant thing to do. You know, it would have given the Oscars some kind of global significance.
Yeah.
And, you know, because, and it would have taken them out of that kind of strange little bubble of politics they get involved in into a real, you know, kind of global moral situation. And for some reason they didn't do it. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Maybe he wasn't available. Maybe he didn't want to speak to them,
yeah,
or maybe,
yeah, well, no,
maybe they didn't want to politicize it, as they call it.
Yeah, I saw Sean Penn. He was on the Polish border.
Sean was in Kiev.
He was very passionate about it.
Yeah.
He seems to have been talking to Zelensky and in touch with him all the time.
So they must have been able to do it.
Yes, you know? It sounded like they chose not to do it.
And can you imagine what that would have been, you know, for this rather slightly failing kind of celebration, the, you know, the kind of figures go down every year, you know, it would have given it a real kind of global significance, I think. But now everyone's just talking about Will Smith smacking the
Did you make of that?
Oh, God, I didn't, you know, I didn't even want to think about it, really, you know. I just thought it's a pity that they didn't, you know, they didn't reinvigorate it in a really interesting way, you know.
Yeah. The Will Smith thing, like, it's not, I don't think it's trivial, though. I mean, it's interesting in what it says about it all, that, okay, you said it was a moment of thuggery. It was kind of a moment of authenticity also, that it seemed to me they did. You don't think so? In what way?
Well, people shouldn't hit people, you know.
Yeah.
And they particularly shouldn't hit people in public.
I'm not saying, they should, yeah.
Yeah.
But that they did not know how to handle it, did they?
I've no idea. It seems like they didn't, you know. It seems like you should have been frog marched out of there, you know what I mean? It seems like the only person who handled it well was the person who was hit, was Chris Rock, you know. But, you know, I mean, it's kind of, I'm sure they'll recover from it, you know. I'm sure, but it was kind of one of those events that makes you feel greasy and horrible, you know, kind of, you know, that's what I felt, you know, but.
Yeah, like. So now we see this morning that he has resigned from the academy, I guess you'd call it. They seem to be now reacting kind of quite slowly and realizing that giving him a standing ovation and best Oscar on the night possibly.
Well, I'm sure it wasn't in their control whether he got a standing ovation or not. You know, people in the audience stood up, I suppose, you know, but they can't control that, can they, really? But yeah, you know, I mean, I'm sure they will recover. I mean, the basic problem is that. When we were nominated for The Crying Game, and when Quentin Tarantino was nominated for Pulp Fiction and all that sort of stuff, and when Steven Soderbergh a few years before was nominated for Sex, Lives and Videotape, the whole story was independent movies kind of encroaching on the mainstream. And now it seems like there are no mainstream movies. There are only independent movies. So the problem is that the movies that are nominated for Oscars, very few people have seen them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's there you have a problem, I think, you know?
Yeah, because it's interesting. The two films that were the kind of favourites for Best Film, the one that won Coda was Apple TV, made for television, essentially, and then The Power of the Dog, Netflix, made for TV as well.
I don't think it matters.
Meanwhile, the cinemas are full of Avengers and Marvel films then, is it?
I know. Like, but you gotta, I mean, you know, I mean, is cinema a broad kind of immersive piece of entertainment, or is it something you watch on your phone?
Yeah.
You know, at the moment it's both things, you know? And I mean, I would love to see, I mean, I thought the film, actually, if you want to tell me the truth, the film I nominated for Best Picture was June. Yeah, not because it was Best Picture, but perhaps it was, just because it deserved that accolade, really, in terms of its, you know, its kind of visual kind of magnificence and in terms of its craft and stuff like that. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And I think that's what people are waiting for again, you know, something like, you know, when The Crying Game was nominated, Clint Eastwood won it for Unforgiven, and I was thrilled because what a wonderful picture that was, you know, and what a wonderful kind of event that people could go to in droves and understand and kind of feel the emotion and feel the moral kind of consequence of this character that Clint played for years.
And so that's all gone. It's like another world, isn't it?
Oh, it's all gone. It's not that long ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's terrifying in a way, isn't it?
I was thinking about the kind of Easy Riders, Raging Bulls generation, call them that.
Scorsese
and all them, and even Lucas and Spielberg and everything.
Yeah.
Would they all be working for Netflix now?
Well, Marty Scorsese is.
I think it's, I would work for Netflix.
I don't mind Netflix.
So that's where the interesting stuff is happening.
Well, that's
is
where
it?
The money is, let's face it, you know.
Okay.
And they're the people who will, you know, finance a filmmaker of real ambition like Martin Scorsese and give him $120 million, which he needs to make whatever movie he's making at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of a bit slightly sad, but I think that's the problem with the Oscars, isn't it, really? You know what I mean? Is that, I mean, I have a term for a kind of movie that I think is, I don't know what I would call it, kind of really good movie that's totally stupid, you know? And there are some movies that are kind of great, but kind of stupid at the same time. And a lot of these kind of independent films have that thing to them, you know?
Yeah, I suppose Don't Look Up was an example of that, was it? Have you seen that?
I saw that, that's a lot of fun.
So on one level it was great, and on another level it felt kind of thrown together, didn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know, maybe I think everyone's been hit hard by the COVID thing, haven't they really? And cinemas have been hit particularly hard, you know?
So they're going to have to fix that model. I was thinking about, like, if you think about your career, and would it be possible now? So you made... So after you won the Oscar, you get a huge budget then to make Interview with a Vampire, if you think about it, like, would they give you money to make this dark kind of film rummage? I know you had Brad Pitt, Tom Cruise rummaging around in the subculture.
Yeah, they would. I think so. Yeah. I mean, look at that movie a couple of years ago. What was it? The Joker,
yeah.
I mean, I know that was based around a kind of a Marvel character, you know what I mean? But... it was savage,
was
not uninteresting as a film, you know, it was kind of...
Yeah, and it was in that space, that subconscious...
In the space kind of dark, that you kind of feel you have to go to see it in the cinema. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's missing, isn't it, in a way, you know.
But then I was thinking about what you did then. So you made Michael Collins after that, but you also went away at that time and made, to my mind... I think it's one of the great Irish films. I love it, which is The Butcher Boy.
Oh yeah,
you go off and make this really small.
Well, that was made by Warner Brothers. Really, yeah, you know. And after I'd made Michael Collins, I made Interview with the Vampire. I made Michael Collins, and they said to me, "What are you doing next?" And I said, "Look, you wouldn't be interested in this. It's kind of a tiny." And they said, "How dare you say we wouldn't be interested? Of course we're interested." And I said, "I really don't think you'd be interested in it, you know."
Yeah.
They said, "Of course we demand to be interested, you know." So I gave them the script and they put quite a bit of money into it. And then I showed them the movie and they go, "What are we going to do with this?" You know, they didn't know how to release it, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Because they weren't an independent company like Miramax or like, you know, Sony Classics, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And is the question then, what was the issue for them at the time? You're saying you're not going to be interested in this, but they're like, Jordan's hot.
It was actually, you know, they were kind of slightly aggrieved. You know what I mean? We are a... picture, you know, we're Warner Brothers, we make interesting movies, you know, we make all kinds of movies. It was that kind of attitude. But I think that's gone, you know, those companies have gone now, haven't they, you know? They can't take those chances anymore, and they don't, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then the whole kind of Miramax adventure, if you want, which did change Hollywood, I think, a lot, didn't it?
Totally, is yeah.
That ended badly, really, didn't it? Do we have to discredit that whole era now because Weinstein was so central to it?
I don't know. Well, you know, I mean, you know, he cheated a lot of people, including me.
What did he do to you?
I took every penny that I should have earned, you know, really, you know. But
go on.
Oh, no. Harvey paid nobody, you know. If he could not pay you, he would not pay you. But
so what did he release for you?
He released a movie called The Miracle and he released The Crying Game.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the United States. Made an enormous amount of money out of it, yeah. But
and you didn't?
Let's not get into that.
But okay.
We, you know, those who should. The crew, let's put it this way, the entire crew because they couldn't, we couldn't afford to pay them their proper salaries. They became kind of investors in the movie, you know.
Okay.
Because they deferred their fees, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And when you defer your fees, you deserve a recompense, you know what I mean? If, and particularly the film performs as well as The Crying Game.
So you almost have points.
You have points in it, yeah. But so what they did, Miramax, they released it in the United States, and it kind of, in about 200 cinemas, it was doing really well. And Harvey came around and he said to everybody, particularly Channel 4, who had put most of the money into the movie, he said, I want to release this big, but I have to spend an enormous amount of money. And I'm not going to spend that amount of money unless people give me their points. Okay. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So everybody who had deferred their fees, you know, lost that deferment. Do you understand what I mean? So he could release it big, and he released it big. He made a fortune, and then he sold the company to Disney. And next, he's going around a private jet, you know. And I didn't know he was abusing every woman he met at the time, you know. But I'm sure some people did. But
how did you find him as an individual?
You want to know the truth?
Yeah.
I don't want to tell you the truth, sorry. Not a nice person.
Tell me a version.
No, not a nice man, I would say. His brother Bob, actually, I liked a lot, you know, but Harvey was a bully, you know.
Yeah.
A real bully.
Yeah. I only met him once very briefly. There was, and even that, there's a bad vibe off him, wasn't there?
Well, I mean, he was a genius at publicity. He was a genius at marketing, you know, absolutely was.
Yeah.
You know, but very often these kind of abilities go with kind of slightly psychopathic tendencies, don't they, you know?
I'm thinking of you in all this, right? So you're
am I a psychopath?
I'm thinking of you in this snake pit of psychopaths. Like a writer who we tend to think of as, you know, slightly introverted, thoughtful people and everything. And then to go into this, start trying to operate in this machine. I presume you have to become a hustler and an operator
really,
and all that.
I mean, what I've found is if you deal with a large company like Warner Brothers or like Columbia, or you know what I mean? With a big, big company, they have to be honest, you know, and they have to pay their debts. They cannot involve themselves in this kind of chicanery. That kind of chicanery often happens on the fringes of the business, which is where Harvey operated, which is where Miramax at the time operated. You know what I mean?
Okay. But I presume at the same time, going from, you know, writing a book and the relatively genteel world of publishing, if you're trying to get projects made and you're trying to, you're watching then how they are, they showing a profit or not, or how are they?
I never cared about that kind of thing, you know. I wasn't as aware of it as I should have been. Let's put it that way, you know.
Can you stay pure in it? You can, and just be an artist in the middle of all that.
You can. I mean, I only started making movies because they excited me, you know, and because my mother was a painter, and she wanted us all to paint when we were kids, and my sister is a painter, and I only started making films because the possibility of making images excited me, you know what I mean? And telling stories through images. So that's just what I followed, you know? And you can, you know, you are, if you put your concentration in the right place, no matter how much money you're spending or how chaotic the procedure is, you know, you still have to compose an image through the camera, you know?
Yeah.
And you still have to talk to the actors, and you know? And you can keep yourself free of those other... You know, you don't have to become a monster to make a movie.
I hope I
become a monster. You know?
Yeah. And when you're dealing with the Tom Cruises and the Brad Pitts and all that, what's the power dynamic there then?
Everybody's insecure, you know, and every actor is insecure.
Yeah.
And every actor wants to give a good performance, you know, and even big, big, big stars are actors, you know, at least the ones I've worked with are actors. Tom Cruise, I think he's actually a superb actor, you know, really great actor. Brad Pitt is a great actor now. You know, at the time when we made Interview the Vampire, he was in that transitionary phase, you know what I mean? Because he was just such a beautiful human being that it almost embarrassed him, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But they're both actors, you know? And with all the insecurity that comes with being an actor, they want to give their best performance, and they need to feel secure that somebody is observing their performance, you know, and making the judgments that will say this is good and this is bad.
Okay. So they want to please you, and they need to.
They don't
trust
want to please you. They want to do good work, and they need somebody that they can trust to make sure the work is good. You know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not that complicated, really. you know.
Is it not, no?
Not really, no, I don't think so. Unless, I mean, if you reduce it to that, it's not that complicated. You know, if you approached it from the concern about who's getting paid what or who is the biggest limo or trailer or who travels to set in a private jet or whatever, it gets complicated. But if you don't worry about that, it's not that complicated, you know.
I saw you say one time that film Interview with a Vampire was actually about guilt, and it struck me that it's a very Irish kind of thing.
That's why I made it.
To bring to a film, yeah.
Anne Rice's, her novel is the kind of one of the greatest expressions of strange Catholic guilt you can ever come across, you know. And when I read it, it was that atmosphere that totally obsessed me. Anne had written a script, and you know, most writers should not be asked to write. If they'd written a novel, they shouldn't adapt their own novel to a screenplay, you know. She kind of left that dark, guilt-ridden thing entirely out, you know.
Okay.
And I said, look, can I have my own go at this for a while? You know, let me read the book again and go through the script again. And, you know, I kind of reintroduced that element, you know. I mean, the problem with the film really was, in the end, it's what they call picaresque, you know. It's not one of these Hitchcockian plots, you know. Mm-hmm. And it follows characters through time and their various adventures, you know, which is a difficult structure to work out. But it was kind of great, really, wasn't it? It was like about
Tom Cruise.
It was about Lestat kind of bitching and moaning at Louis through the centuries.
Yeah. The guilt thing is interesting because I suppose I didn't have a huge sense of this, right? Say I'm about probably, you know, 20 years behind you, maybe a generation behind you in terms of the country we grew up in. I realised when I read Gabriel Byrne's memoir and I subsequently saw his one-man show, I realised that he grew up in a completely different country I did in terms of, like, drenched in the church, wasn't it? And I regard ye as kind of modern rock and roll generation, but it was a different place.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't find that, you know, really. I mean, I suppose like Gabriel, you know, the priest came around when you're in school, like when you're nine. And they said, does any of you have a vocation, you know?
Yeah.
I went to my mother and said, look, I think I should become a priest. She goes, no way. So I was kind
How
of
How old
saved.
Were you at that stage?
I don't know, whenever these kind of men in black come around early and try to seduce you. Like, I think it was late primary. I mean, it must have been, maybe it was early secondary school, yeah.
And what do you think you were attracted to?
Oh, the idea of purity and... The idea of this kind of transcendent kind of vocation. The idea of God going, you, I've chosen you.
It's
kind of terrifying as well as everything else, but, you know. But that's what they told you then. You know? Yeah. But, I mean, I wasn't that.
And when did you leave all that behind?
About a year later.
Oh, really? Yeah.
About that.
But are you scarred by it? Were the kind of
Because I think Gabriel went to be a priest. Didn't
he did, yeah.
No,
yeah,
I never.
Yeah.
I never. No, I wasn't scarred by it. No, I don't think I used to. I used to kind of like it in a way, you know. I mean, but I got out of Dublin when I was about 22. You know, didn't come back for a while. But I used to. I didn't mind. There was a weird, strange innocence to it in a way, you know what I mean? But I mean, I wasn't really aware of it as
an oppressive thing.
Not as an oppressive sexual thing, no. I don't know why I wasn't, you know. But then, you know, then it became, in 1972 with Jim Sheridan, we had a theatre group and we wrote a play about industrial schools, you know. It was called Journal of a Hole, yeah. And we presented it in the early Project Theatre. And, you know, it led to, there was quite a lot of kind of, led to quite a lot of controversy and stuff like that. But that was 1972. And then I was away making movies and traveling and back and forwards. And in the 90s and even the 2000s, all this stuff came out.
Yeah.
I thought, my God, we wrote about that in the 70s. Yeah. You know, I thought it had stopped.
Those places were open up until the 80s.
That's what's profoundly disturbing about Irish life, I find, is that, I mean, you can understand that, you know, around 1968, 1972, you know, you kind of realise, you know, how oppressive and kind of evil these institutions were, you know. Yeah. But the fact that they persisted for, you know, another half a century, that's what's terrifying to me, really, you know.
When you went away from Ireland that time, was that when you ended up homeless?
Ah,
In London?
Yeah. In London. Well, I went to London and I was, what was it? It was an interesting experience. I was waiting for a bunch of people to come over and they never arrived. So I used to wait for these people. I was meant to get an apartment, a flat we could all live in, you know.
Mm.
And what was it? Euston Station. You know, you remember Euston Station? Mm-hmm. There used to be a nice little green there,
yeah.
You know, and I'd go there and wait and they wouldn't come. So I ended up sleeping on the green at the station, you know, and it kind of accelerated into about 3 or 4 months of being filthy, basically, you know.
Yeah.
It was an interesting experience, actually. You realize you become invisible. But I wouldn't call it homelessness. I don't have the option to go back to Dublin, you know what I mean? But I just, you kind of feel ashamed and you don't want to go back, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How quickly do you become kind of, you know...
How quickly do you become filthy?
How quickly do you diverge, yeah.
Two nights, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then are you kind of, to use the modern parents, are you ordered then once you're...
Well, then you're invisible. You're kind of invisible in a way, strange way, you know what I mean? It's a strange thing. And I suppose the people you fraternize with are people who are sleeping rough like yourselves, you know what I mean? But I mean,
What do you do all day?
Huh?
What did you do all day?
I used to wander around with a sandwich board.
Did you?
You know? Yeah. So I was looking for flats. It said 2001 flats. It was advertising flats, yeah. And come on, it wasn't a big experience, but it was an interesting one because it actually showed me how easy it is to become invisible, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I wrote about it, didn't I, in that magazine.
The Big Issue.
The Big Issue. I think that's what people talked about.
But the becoming dirty.
Well, that's the first thing that happened. You actually begin to become covered in grime, you know what I mean? You can't wash. Or if you wash, you wash in a public toilet or something like that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you slowly become, not only that, but you begin to define yourself in the way that other people, you know, kind of perceive you, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard, I think Alice Leahy, there was an attempt at one stage to put showers around the place because I think she feels it's one of the single biggest things you could do actually to improve people's day-to-day lives.
Take your clothes off and have a shower and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So listen, you have Marlo with Liam Neeson coming shortly.
Yeah.
Are you working away?
Yeah.
Has the pandemic and everything becalmed the films?
No. We did this movie during the pandemic, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had two or three scares, but we managed to get through it. It was pretty cool, actually. You know, I didn't go to Los Angeles. It's set in Los Angeles, but we kind of constructed a version of Los Angeles and Barcelona, you know, which... It's a really cool thing to do, actually. It was lovely working with Liam, Jessica Lange, you know, a lot of good actors.
Okay.
Sorry.
Remember, they're probably not listening, luckily for you, all the other good ones that you should be mentioning.
Diane Kruger, Danny Houston.
Yeah. And that's made in the can now, is it? Or
I'm just finalising the cut, you know. So it's a movie set in Los Angeles, but there are big Irish elements in it, you know.
Mm. Okay.
We've turned Marlo into an Irish, given Marlo an Irish background, which will offend some purists, but that's the way it is. Yeah.
So what's the process now, just out of curiosity, before you go? I'm being nosy here now, but when you said final cut, are you in an edit suite somewhere, literally?
Yeah, up in Mount Street, a place called Screen Scene.
You know,
a producer called Al Maloney. Alan has put the financing together quite ingeniously. I don't know how he did it. It's very difficult to get a substantial budget these days. But, you know, we've made a movie, you know, not an tiny independent thing with handheld cameras. We've made a proper film, proper movie, you know.
Okay.
And I like it. It'll be, you know, I love it, actually. We'll see the other people's like it as much as I do. Maybe they won't, you know, but we'll see.
And then you have a cut. Does that need to be approved by someone then? Or how does that work? Or do you know what I mean?
Okay, the way it used to work would be you'd do a cut, yeah?
Yeah.
And you'd go over to Los Angeles and you'd show the guys in suits your cut. And they'd say, oh, okay, I think we should preview this, yeah? And then they'd hire a cinema somewhere in suburbs of LA or somewhere like that. Generally around, you know, Woodland Hills or somewhere in the valley in Los Angeles. And 400 or 500 people would come in, they watch a movie and they'd generally half of them would walk out in the first 20 minutes, you know, that kind of thing. But really, those who remain would watch.
And are you sitting anxiously at the
back? Oh, it's horrible. Yeah. It's a horrible experience, you know. Every time someone gets up and goes to the bathroom, you're terrified. But and then they fill a little form out, you know. They do they like this? Do they like the characters? Yeah. What was confusing? And then they all look at the guys in suits, look at the scores, and they say, hey, you know, if we get these scores up a little bit, maybe we'll have something, you know. And then they recut it and they show it again. Often they can ruin the movie through that process, you know. But we can't do that now because of COVID, which is kind of maybe a blessing in disguise, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know,
okay. they'll take what they're given.
Everyone's going, kind of good. We don't know. I say, okay, we're not going to preview. We can't. Okay, fine.
Cool.
So we'll see what happens. But it's been fun so far.
Okay. Well, listen, that was fun. I could talk to you all day. We have to go. Thank you very much, Neil Jordan, and we'll take a break.
Thank you very much.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.